Okay, welcome back. You're listening to Talk with Francesca. We have here with us now Mark Beckoff. Mark Beckoff is a former professor of ecology and evolutionary biology at the University of Colorado and is a fellow of the Animal Behavior Society and a past Guggenheim Fellow. In 2002, he was awarded the Exemplar Award for the Animal Behavior Society for major long-term contributions to the field of animal behavior. He is also the ambassador for Jane Goodall's Roots and Shoots program, in which he works with students of all ages, seniors, and prisoners. I think I'll stop here. Welcome, Mark, for being on Talk with Francesca. I'm always thrilled to talk to you. Great to have you here.
Well, thanks. It's good to be talking to you.
Mark, I was reading your article in Psychology Today that animals grieve and mourn and have other psychological disorders. Knowing that animals have that level of feeling puts even more pressure on us to give our animals attention. It seems that more and more we're finding out that animals have rich emotional lives. Can you elaborate on how dogs deal with psychological issues?
Well, sure. I mean, dogs, like all other animals, deal with psychological issues in a variety of ways. You know, when they're happy and they're playing and they're with their friends, you know, they experience joy and glee like humans would. And when they're sad about something, they experience grief and sorrow. You know, when I say like we do, what I mean really is that dog grief and dog joy doesn't have to be the same as ours. I mean, my joy and your joy may not be the same, but it doesn't mean I have it and you don't, or vice versa. But there's no doubt that, you know, across mammals, and now we're learning more about birds and fish, perhaps even insects, they're sentient beings, and they have a wide range of emotions. So there's just a study a couple of months ago that showed that chickens display empathy. Last month, there was a study that showed that rats display empathy. And there was a wonderful study a couple of months ago, too, that showed that honeybees can become pessimists. So the more we, you know, the more we study other animals, the more we learn about their fascinating lives.
Do animals have, do they get post-traumatic stress disorder?
Oh, yeah. I mean, excuse me, there's classic studies of that. Across the board, like chimpanzees in captivity are known to develop PTSD, same exact psychological deficits and symptoms that humans have. Same with elephants. In fact, the early cases for PTSD in animals came from looking at elephants who had seen or heard or smelled their families and friends being killed. I actually met some young elephants who were suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder when I was in Kenya. And it just takes years to try to rehabilitate them, and some of them are not, just can't be rehabilitated. And so, and then once again, you know, if you want to extend it to other animals, you know, all, I mean, among mammals, there's no doubt that dogs and their wild relatives like wolves and coyotes, foxes, could also get PTSD. So, you know, once again, we're discovering fascinating things about animals, especially how they can be very psychologically sensitive, just like you and me.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Why is it that so often our dogs, for example, seem to have similar qualities to their companions? Is it my imagination?
Well, you mean to their human companions?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I don't think you're imagining anything.
I really think there's a lot to that, you know?
Sure. I mean, you know, because they imitate, they mimic, they model, just like, you know, human children will say on the adults with whom they live. So, no, I think that we, you know, have enough information now to show very clearly that, you know, dogs just get on the same schedules as their humans, and they often display emotions, or display the same emotions, if you will, in similar situations. So I don't think you're imagining anything, but it makes complete sense, in the sense that they're mammals, and if you want to cash it out in terms of their brains, all mammals have a structure in their limbic system called the amygdala,
right?
A little almond-shaped structure.
Yeah.
So, across the board, every mammal has the same neural architecture and the same neurochemicals. So, once again, if we model or mimic or imitate, so too do other animals? And you know, and you can extend that back to the early questions about joy, grief, sadness, PTSD. Mm-hmm. So that's what's fascinating is, you know, if you're a good biologist and you believe in Charles Darwin, who, you know, really argued that there's what we call evolutionary continuity mm-hmm. among animals, which means basically that there are shades of gray in terms of the differences among animals, not black and white differences. So the bumper sticker for continuity is simply if we have it, they, you know, other animals have it too.
And so, okay, do animals know, or our pets, I should say, do they know what we're thinking? I mean, are they that connected to us that it's almost like an emotional mirror?
Yeah, and that's a great word, because we've also discovered mirror neurons that basically mirror different actions. And not only do mammals have it, but we know birds have a mirror neuron. So, you know, once again, I think what happens with other animals, including other human animals, is that if you've lived with somebody long enough, you're really good at making predictions about what they're going to do in a certain situation, or you're good about making predictions of what they're thinking or feeling mm-hmm. When they say something in a particular way, or, you know, in terms of our companion animals, mm-hmm. when their voice is at a certain tone or they adopt a certain posture. And once again, you know, it's a no-brainer. I mean, you know, for all of us who have lived with dogs, when I stood in a certain way, Jethro knew he was going for a walk, and then I wouldn't even say walk, because then I know he would go crazy.
They really do go crazy, don't they? When you say, I have to say W-A-L-K, but yeah,
exactly,
I think my dog knows how to spell now.
But he would know just from my posture, and I finally I would play games with him, and he loved it, because, you know, dogs love to be enriched. They love to be challenged in nice and positive ways, of course. And so I would stand in certain ways, and you know how your dog would sit next, sort of sit looking at you, cocking their head from side to side.
Yeah.
What is that crazy human doing?
Well, you know, I hope that our listeners all have dogs. Otherwise, they're going to think we've got two nuts on the
right.
air right about now. But, yeah, it's funny, because just last night my dog just wanted some water. He has this little quirky habit. He'll get on the bed, mm-hmm. and it seems like, you know, we're ready to go to sleep, and then he starts with, just like a little,
mm-hmm.
And I say, okay, he wants water. My husband looks at me like, what? Yeah, that's exactly what he wants. And so I bring the water right up to the bed. And, you know, but it's almost like, why do you wait until I get into the bed and then decide that you're thirsty?
Exactly. Well,
is it because he's trying to be the alpha dog? Because I don't believe in any of that stuff.
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think part of it just could be coincidence. Part of it, I mean, you know, dogs like playing with us, too. And that's why I've loved living with dogs and, you know, having, I mean, other animals around, is you develop this real interactive dynamic, reciprocal dynamic.
Yeah.
And sometimes I would get really upset. You know, I'd say, geez, Jethro, I just got in bed. But he knew exactly what he was doing. And it wasn't manipulative. He wasn't trying to make me angry. The fact of the matter is I reinforced him, because the first time he started playing that game, I'd get out of bed and do it. And then he'd go, oh, wow, if I do this, Mark will get out of bed and do this.
Let's talk about alpha dogs a little bit. Years ago, I had gotten my dog, and my neighbor had said, now just make sure you're the alpha dog. Now, I'm going to tell you, I am not the alpha dog, yet I don't think my dog is the alpha dog either, which I think is really interesting, because we get along just fine. You know, my husband, myself, the dog, and there is no boss in the family. Now, I mean, there are certainly things that the dog knows that he must obey, but we kind of pamper him. So I'm not so sure I buy into that alpha dog thing.
Well, a lot of people don't, because I think they make the wrong inferences about being alpha. Being alpha doesn't necessarily mean being a control freak or being dominant. Oftentimes in wild animals, you know, I studied coyotes for years. I've studied wolves. The animal who you call alpha may be the leader when mm-hmm. animals move. Other animals may defer to him or her, mm-hmm. but it's not alpha in terms of continual fighting. And so people really vary on their opinions, but, you know, in some ways, because you control your dog, you do, and I don't mean control in a bad way,
mm-hmm.
They're going to look at you as being the leader. So So that's my take on it. Okay. I've been involved talking to some people because I think a lot of people don't understand the nuances of the word alpha or the nuances of to dominate. But, you know, Jethro, my dog, I use him because he's, you know, he died years ago, but, you know, he's my last dog who I've really lived closely with. I mean, he just knew I controlled his life. I opened the door so he could go out and pee. I would give him his food. Yep. I mean, he was really good about breaking into the food closet, I can tell you that. But, but finally, I figured out, you know, a way to stop him. But you know, dogs are, I mean, that your question is a great one because dogs are really dependent on us. We're their oxygen.
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
You know, we could lock a dog in the closet 24/7, and when we let them out, they wag their tail and they lick us.
It's amazing.
You know, I think that we, and that really, you know, bears on questions about responsibility to our companion animals. Mm-hmm. They have rich emotional lives. They're really smart. We know that they have moral sensibilities and they know right from wrong. And so they depend on us. And so when we mistreat them, especially our companion animals, it's a double cross. I mean, we, you know, we've domesticated them. We raise them to be the beings who we want them to be. And they expect that we are going to have their best interests in mind.
Absolutely. If you're just tuning in, where you're listening to Talk with Francesca, we're speaking to Mark Beckoff, who is the author of The Emotional Life of Animals. Mark, talk to me practically here. What is the best way to get along with your pet?
I think the best way is to be very sensitive to their needs, to love them unconditionally, to...
That's pretty easy to do.
Well,
how
yeah,
can you not?
A lot of people don't walk the talk. Make sure they get a lot of exercise. Make sure they feel loved. You know, let them know that, you know, like I said, you've got their best interests in mind. And they really do, like I said before, you know, we're their oxygen. They really do depend on us. But the best way is just, you know, we've made a choice. Each individual who lives with a companion animal, it can be a dog, a pet, a cat, a fish, a bird, made the choice to do so. And that's one thing I always say in my lectures and in my books. We made that choice. Nobody said that you have to have this animal.
Right.
And it's like the choice you make of having a child. You've brought a being into your life, and you should treat them with respect. And once again, we are totally, totally in control of their lives.
Mark, let me ask you, let's just switch gears here just for a minute. I want to ask you why animals, I just don't understand this, dogs, why are they so freaked out with thunderstorms that they now have to wear these special coats when it rains? And by the way, I don't think these special coats are doing anything. I don't think it even works. But, you know, where is this coming from? It seems I hear more and more that animals are freaked out by thunderstorms. I mean, this is nature. You know,
I can't answer your question really directly. I've lived with a plethora of dogs over the years, some of whom were freaked out by thunderstorms. And then once again, my dog Jethro and another dog I had, Inuk, they couldn't care less about thunderstorms. They would go out in thunderstorms. They wouldn't tear my bed apart, you know, trying to hide.
Yep.
And then I had a dog named Sky who, when the thunder would pin herself in the corner and dig. She once dug up 3/4 of a room of carpet because she was so upset. I think it's the high-pitched sound.
Yeah.
I think it's the sudden noise. It's the unpredictability of it. So Sky didn't mind loud music. She didn't. If she were attentive, she didn't mind. Like if a pot dropped off of the stove or off of a shelf, she would startle, but she wouldn't freak out. I think the thunder is high pitched, and mm-hmm. sometimes the lightning accompanies it. You know, a lot of people
You're
think
right.
that it's a very primitive response from early dogs, early animals. I don't know that. I can't say, but I have to say that I don't know. I haven't kept track of this, but I would have to say that of all the people who I know who have dogs, it's probably give or take 50% or 60% who are freaked out by thunderstorms.
Here, I've got a question from a listener, Jen from Winthrop. She wants to know, what is the most important thing our dog can teach us?
The most important thing I think that dogs can teach us is commitment and love. And I qualify that because a lot of people say dogs love unconditionally. A lot of popular writers say that. No, they don't love unconditionally, but when they love, they love. If they choose to bring us into their lives, mm-hmm. then they love us and they respect us. And I really say that because I think it demeans dogs to say that they love unconditionally and they love everyone. All the dogs with whom I lived made choices. I mean, they loved just about everyone, but right. there were people who they weren't especially fond of.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I think commitment to relationship and love, you know, defined as a close bond, having your best interests in mind is probably to me the most emotional. And then from love, of course, comes trust. So
right.
they're two, I think they're closely bound up.
What is your Roots and Shoots program about?
Roots and Shoots is a program that Jane Goodall founded about 20 years ago in Kenya. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, in Tanzania. It basically is concerned with the well-being of non-human animals, human animals, and environments. So it's animals, people, and the environment. It's probably in 100 countries now. There's probably 4,000 groups, maybe 100,000 individual members.
Wow.
And it's a program that really involves activities. I do it with prisoners now. I do it with young people. I do it with senior citizens. And it's just getting them to be sensitive to the well-being of other animals, other people, and, you know, taking care of the environment. It could be different projects. I had a little boy who shoveled the snow for an older woman who was his neighbor, walk her dog, get her mail. So there he was, you know, taking care of her dog, another animal, taking care of her, and then shoveling her sidewalk when it snowed. So it's very action-oriented. It's not necessarily, you know, goal-directed. You don't necessarily get a gold star, but it's to do good things and to learn to respect other animals, people, and the environment.
Well, then here, I have another question from a listener, so this is actually kind of timely. Bob from Quincy asks, you are a scientist, yet seem to be motivated by your heart. How do you balance that?
Well, I balance it in that I love science, and I've always come to science with compassion and heart. I mean, historically, I never wanted to dissect animals, and I didn't. I dropped out of a PhD MD program because I didn't want to use dogs in research. So I'm not tooting my own horn. It's just my whole inclination forever has been to want to learn about other animals and to respect them. So I'm one of those who says, you know, you don't have to dissect animals and abuse other animals in order to learn about them. And I think it's, in fact, just 2 days ago, I had this wonderful email. I get a lot of them, but a very thoughtful woman who's a junior in college and just said, I want to study biology. I want to study animal behavior and conservation, but I don't want to dissect or kill animals. But my professors say I have to in order to become a biologist. And, of course, I'm going to talk to her this week. You don't have to.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the old paradigm. My mentor did it. My mentor's mentor did it. So I appreciate that question. But I think that you can do great science with feelings for the animal. And we're learning that now, too. Mm-hmm. And of course, the more we learn about the emotional lives of animals and their moral lives and how they suffer, the more responsibility we have to treat them with respect when we study them.
Absolutely. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Talk with Francesca. We're talking to Mark Beckoff. He is a tireless animal activist and prolific author. Another question for you here. Rachel from Cambridge. Do you think dogs have souls, Mark?
Well, I do. And I say that from a number of points of view. I say it, if we have souls, they have souls.
Right.
I also say it because I do a lot of work with theologians. And the ones with whom I work are not offended by that. In other words, to say dogs or other animals have souls doesn't mean that humans don't have souls or that not, you know, we're not special in other ways. So do I know this for a fact? No. Do I know that humans have souls? No. But I think good biology would warrant us at least granting them the possibility and the likelihood that if we have souls, they have souls.
Okay, got another question here. Jim from Watertown. It's been said that dogs know when people have cancer. How and what do they do differently?
I think it's based on odor. And, you know, if you go online, I wrote an article recently about dogs detecting cancer, strokes, diabetes. And I think what it is that we, when we sweat, our sweat and our odor really changes. And I think what they're tuning into is a change. And it might be an odor that alarms them or alerts them. I don't think people really know the basics of it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there's this classic story of a dog who saved his human companion when he had a heart attack. And the man went back to work, and he was allowed to bring his dog to work because people feared he might have another heart attack. Well, one day the dog got up and ran across the office and sat next to one of this guy's colleagues. And nobody could figure out what was going on. And the dog got really edgy. And it turned out this guy was having a heart attack.
Amazing.
So the dog, you know, learned that a certain odor was associated with something bad, if you will. You know, I don't think the dog is sitting there and going, oh, my goodness, Joe had a heart attack. Now Bob's having one. But he's knowing that there's something unusual going on. So, I mean,
okay.
You know, people have experienced this across the board now with many dogs.
Mark Beckoff, thank you so much for being with us here today on Talk with Francesca.
My pleasure, Francesca. Good luck with all the good things you do.
Okay, thanks so much.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, we're about to wrap things up. Wow, it went way too fast. If you want to know more about what's ahead on Talk with Francesca, visit my website at talkwithfrancesca.com and click on upcoming shows. And, of course, if you missed some of the show today, it'll be posted on my website always. Thank you so much for being with us here today. Have a fantastic week, and I hope I gave you something to talk about. See you next week. Don't try.